and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a markets reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team here at Bloomberg. This week on the show, President Trump threw a bombshell into markets at the end of the week by announcing tariffs on Mexico if the country does not prevent the flow of illegal immigrants into the United States. And this comes at a time when U.S. and China still seem no closer on reaching a trade deal between themselves. So trade is still dominating the headlines.
One of our guests will walk us through how to actually trade a trade war. And the bonds rally has kind of taken on a mind of its own. Has it gone too far, or are 10-year Treasury yields now headed toward 2%?
And of course, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. But first, we'll talk about President Trump and his threats to place tariffs on Mexico if they do not stop the flow of illegal immigrants into the country. Here to talk about it is Brian Chapata, a Bloomberg opinion columnist who focuses on fixed income markets. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, the sort of knee-jerk reaction to this new threat of tariffs on Mexico was very much risk-off. We saw a rally in bonds, a steep sell-off in stocks, interest rates obviously going much lower, that 2% on the 10-year really coming into focus next. Is the market overreacting here, considering that President Trump has been known to sort of bluff or at least change his mind in the past?
Well, I think the market is very confused right now because you had these China trade war possibilities, and that was sort of well telegraphed, but Mexico sort of came out of nowhere. There was an agreement largely in place, the USMCA, and there's this question of, okay, if there's a deal in place and you could still arbitrarily throw some tariffs onto a country, what does this mean for the China front? So now you're fighting a two-front trade war, and the question becomes, at what point will this just completely mess up global supply chains, the overall markets, and ultimately the U.S. economy? And that's when you start to get a risk off. You start to see a lot of people buy up treasuries.
It's certainly messing up a lot of weekends for financial journalists and traders, I imagine, at least. But Brian, so much of the pricing in the bond market revolves around inflation and what people are expecting for inflation going forward. Now, obviously, a new round of tariffs on Mexico, while we're still waiting for the goods from China to arrive on the boats with that new set of tariffs, the implication, obviously, is that at least some of these expenses from the tariffs will be passed on to consumers, which should have an inflationary effect. But yet the bond market is reacting as if it's expecting less inflation going forward. Could you sort of walk us through what the bond market is thinking and why traders seem to think the Fed's next move will be even more aggressive cuts rather than a rate hike to respond to higher prices?
Yeah, well, I think this definitely is not the kind of price increases and inflation that the Fed wants to see. It should be more of an organic, natural thing fueled by, you know, wage gains and general economic growth. And this is more of a one-time hit as a result of this policy from the Trump administration. So I think it's sort of a trade-off between inflation and growth. And I think the bond market is saying this is going to be a bigger hit on economic growth. And the Fed will look through this idea that prices are going up because of these tariffs on China and on Mexico. And that's why you're seeing the possibility of a rate cut. Although, to be fair, various Fed officials, including Neel Kashkari, one of the more dovish among the Fed officials throughout the country, sort of says, we're okay where we are right now. We don't need to do anything.
We're likely to hear that word transitory again, just to a different meaning this time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, everyone's sort of playing game theory with the tariffs. And obviously, President Trump has been very actively going against the Fed, saying if I only got some Fed help, we'd be doing even better than we are right now. And China's going to get all this stimulus and I'm not going to get anything. So there's a bit of game theory potentially going on. I'm not sure if that's exactly the motivation here. I mean, tying these Mexico tariffs to immigration is sort of out of left field and kind of bizarre, frankly. It feels a little arbitrary, and it's unclear exactly whether, you know, when the 5% goes to 10%. I mean, there are dates, but when, you know, Mexico does enough for Trump to say, okay, we don't need to tariff you anymore, is very unclear.
And now let's turn our attention to the other trade war that's been dominating headlines, the tensions between the U.S. and China. And joining us to break it all down is Lori Calvasina,
the head U.S. equity strategist at RBC. Also spent some time at Credit Suisse, if I'm not mistaken. And Sarah, a graduate of the University of Virginia. So congratulations to that basketball team.
We're all begrudgingly saying congratulations.
Yeah. Yes.
But we're really
yes.
happy for you.
Not me. I'm happy. I went to the University of Delaware, which is actually a knockoff of UVA. Like, they literally copied the campus at Delaware. So this is like as close to a national championship as I'm going to get, I think. So I'm happy.
We're excited.
Lori, you guys actually put out a report this week called How to Trade a Trade War, 21 pages long, very in-depth. You guys went through every single earnings call transcript from the last season. You also surveyed your guys' company analysts. How can you actually go about it? It's clearly not that simple.
It's very, very tough. And I think what's complicated matters is right after that initial Trump tweet a few weeks ago, we felt like people were in denial. They just didn't want to think about it. They said, okay, this escalation isn't actually going to go through on Friday. And then it did. And then people were sort of in a state of shock saying, okay, well, there's this window. It's probably not actually going to happen. And guess what? Like, you know, last week, it felt like the middle of last week, clients were saying, we actually have to figure out how to position for this in our portfolios. And so we went to our analysts. We gave them about 24 hours. And we said, you've had some time to think about this. Within your industry, what would you buy and what would you sell? What's most at risk? What's least at risk? We really wanted to understand, as the news ebbs and flows, what are the both sides of the trade? Just let's have these lists ready to go. We also asked the analysts to just standardize their thoughts. And really, we tried to assess their gut feel. I think investors right now, they want hard data. They want hard numbers. I don't think it's possible to get them yet. And we just said, what's going to be the impact to demand? What's going to be the impact to margins? And when we did that, we found that we actually had some very clear sector and industry takeaways. There were some very clear leans and tilts that we saw develop. We cross-referenced that with some work we did analyzing transcripts. And we literally went through all 500 transcripts through the last three reporting seasons.
How much time does that take?
So much time. And this is not something we all did last week. This is something we do every reporting season. But we've been characterizing what companies say on trade. And we had like six or seven different categories. And we said, let's just put those into two basic categories, good and bad. And when we did that, we found that the sector takeaways pretty much lined up with what our analysts thought.
Yeah, I feel like everybody is sort of looking at the sales and revenue exposure to China, and you don't hear much about the cost exposure, what companies are importing from China. Is that data sort of harder to come by, harder to quantify?
Well, there's a reason everybody's running those revenue numbers, because it's in footnotes and financial statements. The cost estimates are not. And
right.
So that's why you don't see it. We actually made a purposeful decision not to look at that revenue data. We know everybody's looking at that. And we know largely you're talking about semis and technology when you're talking about companies that list direct China exposure. We think everybody knows about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was interesting to me is that as we went through the different sectors, it was very clear consumer discretionary, industrials, tech, and materials are really the most at-risk areas. It wasn't too much of a difference in terms of impact on margins and impact on demand. Analysts answered those questions largely the same. Areas that were more immune, communication services, utilities, REITs, just no real direct exposure. Everything else was somewhere in the middle.
We've heard about the macro trade book before, the playbook, you could call it. And a lot of people have said, okay, go into small caps, get out of emerging markets, get out of China, get out of semiconductors. This week, we actually kind of saw the opposite. I thought it was pretty amazing that we saw emerging markets, we saw China, we saw semiconductors actually outperforming and small caps underperforming. Is it the idea that maybe you need to get a little more granular, a little bit more micro? Or is it the idea that right now investors are just still unsure of what to do?
Well, I think it's a question of applying the risk and factoring in the risk to different parts of the market at different points in time. And I think the semiconductor one has been a really obvious one for a very long time. If you want to go in and run a screen just looking at Chinese revenue exposure, you're going to get a big list of semi companies. And everybody knows that. And everyone was doing that analysis back in the fall. Now I think people are starting to look at the retailers, which are really more affected by list four.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really had that on their time horizon. Nobody really thought that was even within the realm of possibility. So that's where all the focus is right now.
One thing I find interesting in your recent reports, you're neutral as far as small caps versus large caps. And I'm interested in this because I've been on TV a few times when the market's really bad and the anchor will say, well, small caps are doing worse than large caps. You know, aren't they immune to the trade war? And my answer is always like, well, they're immune to a strong dollar. But if you look at the makeup of small caps, I mean, a lot of banks, a lot of consumer discretionary at risk to import costs, obviously higher beta in small caps. So when the market goes down, they're going to go down a little bit more. I mean, can you give me a smarter answer than that?
Well, I spent about 7 years as a small cap strategist in the past. And I can tell you that there are kind of two issues that small caps are always in the epicenter of. One is they're risk on or risk off. So bad news, generally, small caps go down. But then sometimes they benefit in a more fundamental way, and they don't always get credit for that. I think it's even more complicated right now. Yes, small caps are more domestic, so things like the small cap banks, really no exposure to the trade war unless we get pulled into a recession. But other than that, they should be fine. Retailers are more complicated because they have margin pressures. And it goes back to these cost pressures that we can't really measure, we can't really screen for. But what we know is that smaller companies in any sector have less scale, they have less bargaining power, they have less of an ability to manage issues like this. They can't manage their supply chains quite as deftly as the big cap companies. And I think that's what's hurting them right now.
Another thing that caught my eye is you have a preference for financials, energy and financials. Energy is one story, but I'm kind of surprised at financials, given our guy Brian here has been writing about this panic buying in treasuries. I mean, flat inverted yield curves, you know, intuitively you would think would be bad for net interest margins at financials. So what are you seeing there to sort of catch your eye?
So we think the yield curve, when it really hurts the banks, we think it's more about the economic signal that it's sending. And we tell people continue to look at the preponderance of the evidence. The yield curve is one signal. We don't think the U.S. economy is going to tip into recession this year, but we do admit and acknowledge that it's an anchor, it's an overhang, it's a problem. We like the valuation story in financials. We like the fact that investors are starting to really struggle to find more defensive places to hide in the market. Healthcare has really broken down as a defensive proxy. So we think the relative immunity of something like the trade war and the financials could actually benefit them. But the yield curve is definitely a problem.
That's a good segue in you, Brian. The yield curve is inverted again. We're all going to die, right? Is that that's the signal?
That's what it means.
Do I have it right? So what tell us about what you've been writing. You had a piece talking about this panic buying in treasuries, but it doesn't sound like you think it's been overdone, that you think these yields are lower for longer, to use a catchphrase from a few years ago. I mean, is that where we are again? We're back to this permanent low yield environment?
I mean, it feels like that's sort of the end game, no matter how you spin it, right? I mean, there's been so much buildup of debt across the world. The, you know, economy has become so financialized. Everyone's exposed to equities. I mean, the only way to sort of keep all of this going without some sort of major problem is by keeping yields low. And that's what we've seen in Japan for a long time. It's what we've seen in Europe. And in the US, the Fed was able to get several rate hikes off, but ultimately they're going to have to lower rates again at some point. And so it is a concern. I mean, I think that in the short term, the rally has gone quite far. Jeff Gundlach came out on Twitter and said, you know, we've seen a top and people are going to sort of have buyer's remorse now. And I think that's probably right. I mean, the 10-year yield is below the lower bound of the Fed funds rate. So if the Fed's going to stay on hold, it doesn't look
what are you doing
quite so good. What are you doing at, you know, 220? But it sort of feels like we're in this environment where the Fed's not going to raise anymore. That's for sure. They might cut at some point in the next 2 years. And so bond traders are trying to get ahead of this. And that's why you see the long end rally and the curve invert.
How much dispersion do you actually see in Wall Street views right now? Because I know you look at Bank of America, they're calling for yields potentially to fall to 2.05 on the 10-year. Then you mentioned Jeff Gundlach. I know macro risk advisors, a couple other shops have come out and said, we are going to see a pop in interest rates. We can't stay around 2.2. I mean, are you just seeing a lot of different opinions at this point in time?
I mean, I think it's pretty universal right now that everyone's coming down,
right?
Because they're following the market. That's for sure. It seems like, especially among economists, there's a major reluctance to capitulate and say we're heading back down towards 2% when it seemed very clear that we were headed towards 3% and possibly even 4%. But among the fixed income treasuries, interest rate strategists specifically, there is a feeling that we're sort of stuck in a range. we've sort of seen the top for this cycle back in October and November when the yield was 3.2, 3.25%. So, you know, I guess we'll sort of see what happens here, but I think the move is definitely lower now.
Now, Lori, obviously a big part of this move into bonds is likely people getting a little spooked at the stock market. You wrote recently that you do think people will come in and quote unquote buy the dip, to use everyone's favorite catchphrase, but we're not quite there yet. What sort of downside do you think we need to bring in those dip buyers? And will it require a catalyst? You know, will it be a midnight tweet from a certain president to do it? What valuations? What would cause that dip buying instinct to kick in?
Well, I think that I don't think we're going to get there on valuation. Our valuation model's been pretty stretched, and it's getting a little bit better, but we're kind of nowhere near cheap territory yet. Mm-hmm. So I think that's off the table as the catalyst to get people back in. I do think you have to look back at history to some extent. And if you go back to 2010, 2011, 2016, we had these ferocious rallies off the bottom, but they had these, you know, sort of different periods of consolidation that were sparked by different things. And a lot of them went down to about 10%. And that seems to be the line in the sand where, within the context of a recovery, the market says, okay, if we go any farther, we're pricing in a growth scare, we're pricing in a really dire economic scenario. I think you watch that 10% mark. It's around 2650 this time around. My sense is there, investors will say, okay, we're not in the recession camp. This has probably gone too far, and that's where they'll step back in.
Now, hypothetically, though, if the data deteriorates, you know, we're looking at the ISM numbers, inching close to 50, that, you know, line in the sand between contraction and expansion. If you have a 10% equity dip and a sub 50 ISM, I mean, is the same hold true? And maybe some other disturbing economic data?
I think if the 10% doesn't hold and you get deteriorating economic data in a significant way that says, okay, the recession issue is back on the table for this year, you're looking at a 20% type decline. I mean, that's what we basically saw happen on the December 24th
right.
lows. And that's pretty close to what your average recessionary drop is, peak to trough.
Is that what the bond market is pricing in, though, Brian? I mean, the idea of low growth, low inflation. Obviously, the market is now looking for a Fed rate cut.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be the real big. That's what effectively bond traders are sort of daring the Fed to do a rate cut. And I mean, I think that if the data comes in weak, the Fed will respond. But I don't think that the Fed really wants to sort of let the market steer its direction, at least throughout the rest of this year. I think 2020 seems like a reasonable time when the Fed may start to see signs of weakness and reason to sort of start dropping rates a little bit in hopes of this fabled soft landing. But I think they're really, really going to try to look through. We sort of saw that most recently with the sort of transitory comments on inflation. People were expecting that the Fed was going to change its tune, noticed that inflation was missing 2% constantly, and acknowledged that. But Jay Powell did not want to go there.
Now, another caveat out this week, Brian, is, and I think this stems from Bloomberg Television sent a bunch of people out to PIMCO in Southern
right.
California. I'm not saying I'm jealous that, you know, some people got to go to California. I'm not saying I'm not jealous either, but they came back with an interesting story, and that is that PIMCO has gotten pretty bearish on credit. Walk us through their thinking on why they're sort of getting a little scared about the credit markets.
Yeah. So, I mean, I respect PIMCO and their investors a ton. And I think they're right to point out that I think they said that the corporate credit was the riskiest that they've ever seen, or to some extent, and that CLOs were going to have a bunch of losses when the cycle turns. And that's true, but it's also not exactly the most novel point of view that we've
right.
ever seen, right? I mean, we know that triple Bs now make up $3 trillion worth of the investment grade index. That's a lot. And companies have gone down the credit scale in order to, you know, lock in, you know, a lot of debt, but also, you know, expand. And that's like one way they can do that. And CLOs are 2/3 of the market. So obviously they are going to take the majority of the losses. So, I mean, I think that they are bearish, but they're also sort of just more broadly acknowledging that things are probably going to get tougher from here on out. We're a decade into the expansion, And you know, everyone keeps saying we're in the eighth inning or the ninth inning or extra innings or whatever.
Right. Goes on forever, longest
right.
game.
But like ultimately, at some point, they're going to be right, and they have a 3 to 5 year outlook. So they say, you know, these next 3 to 5 years, we're probably going to end the game, and you know, something's going to turn, and things are not going to be so rosy for just plowing into whatever has the highest yield.
You know, it's funny. I feel like I've read about 10 different obituaries for the credit cycle over the last 5 years.
Right, and
it hasn't happened yet.
Recession is always 2 years away.
It hasn't happened. But Lori, you know, obviously the traditional thinking is that the credit markets sort of lead the equity markets to some degree. I'm curious if you buy that. And also if we are in for a worsening in the credit markets, you know, obviously the last time that happened was a big deal, caused the Great Recession, caused, you know, this enormous bear market in stocks. I mean, focused on the mortgage market, but is the equity market a little more insulated from problems in the credit land than it was then? And, you know, what's your thinking? How do you sort of incorporate signals from the credit market into how you're looking at stocks?
So I would say that the primary way we do it is we look at the small cap trade and we look at high yield and what's the signal that we're getting from high yield. And we've started to see spreads widen a little bit, which is telling us some of this weakness in small cap is justified. But at the same time, there's nothing particularly scary there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we spent a ton of time on this issue back in the fourth quarter when, for lack of a better word, every multi-asset investor I talked to was absolutely freaking out about debt levels mm-hmm. in corporate America. So we did a ton of work on this. And what we found is that if you look at the S&P landscape, things are pretty manageable. Things don't look that bad. Interest expense relative to sales, very carefully contained. There's been a big rise in long-term debt, short-term debt, variable rate debt. It's all very low. That's the scary stuff. When you look in the smaller companies, things don't look quite so good. Variable rate debt has been going up. There are certain sectors where it's a little bit worse than others. So I feel like there are pockets of risk in the market, but it's not as widespread. It's not as deep as it's been in the past.
In the beginning of the year, I remember a lot of people suggesting or advising that companies start moving, well, investors start moving away from companies with higher debt levels because we were going to see higher interest rates. But now if that is off the table, can you kind of go back to these riskier companies that have higher debt levels?
I think that you can, as long as you think we're not headed into a recession imminently. Mm-hmm. I think as soon as the recession chatter picks up again, that you'll start to see people put those trades that they put on in the fourth quarter, they'll go right back to them. But if you're kind of in this Goldilocks scenario or the sluggish growth environment, you're probably okay to look for bargains. And we did see a lot of investors hunting around for bargains in some of those more highly leveraged areas. You know, we used to hear a lot about this on consumer staples as a reason not to buy the staples companies, but nobody talks about it anymore.
You know, Lori, I also noticed you had a government studies major.
Yes.
at UVA.
Yes.
So it's coming in handy these days, I guess, right?
It is.
More than you probably thought it would.
I never thought I'd actually be putting my degree to work, but here we go.
So, you know, we're getting to that point where politics and markets are on a collision course again for next year. Walk us through how we should think about that. You know, how closely should we watch the poll numbers? That sort of thing.
So I think you've got to keep an eye on them. And I think, to be honest, investors are really underestimating the amount of political risk that's out there. I think we're all focused on the trade war right now, but I think the next big political issue that's coming back is the 2020 election. And when you go through and you think about how it can impact markets on an issue and an industry basis, it gets pretty, you know, frightening is not exactly the right word, but it gets really concerning. We did, again, a couple of surveys. We talked to investors. We talked to our analysts. And with our analysts, we said, look at your industry. Give us an issue. You know, think about it from an issue perspective. Don't just tell me Republicans, you know, are better for the market and Democrats are bad. We don't want to hear that. But, you know, look at your industry. Is there something the Democratic contenders are talking about that could be bad for your stocks? And we went through, we found a whole big list, and we mapped it out by sector. And we found that it was really, you know, consumer staples, utilities, REITs, and industrials, oddly enough, were really the only areas that didn't have some specific policy issue that the progressive candidates on the Democrats, you know, would hurt.
Is there any overarching concern about the tax rate that these corporate tax cuts we've saw in the last couple of years will, you know,
eliminated.
I had a few analysts mention that when we did it in the survey, but I'll tell you honestly, it does not come up at all in conversations with investors. It's arguably something we should be thinking about a little bit as a risk, but I think it's more issues like Medicare for All, drug pricing, Green No Deal, tech sector regulation, where you know we've seen Elizabeth Warren in particular be very vocal.
Yeah, break up the fangs.
And they're the market leaders, so that does get to be very concerning.
With healthcare, does this kind of become a binary trade?
Well, you know, it's interesting on healthcare. We actually think that and tech have risk on both sides of the political aisle. And if you go all the way back to the 2016 election, Trump was talking about drug pricing, and he started to talk about it a little bit this year as well. And if you go back to the midterm elections, the Democrats are convinced that they did very well in the House races in particular on the basis of campaigning on healthcare. Republicans are aware of that. And with the White House support, we actually think odds are something does happen on healthcare, regardless of how the election comes out. Just because both sides are very, very attuned to it as an issue that their constituents care about.
Brian, does anyone in the bond market care about the elections? I mean, clearly no one's going to run on a balanced budget platform,
right.
I'm assuming.
Right. But, I mean, I guess MMT sort of creeps into the conversation every now and then, and the idea of just running persistent deficits and letting fiscal spending carry the day, you know, that could boost long-term rates with the prospect of higher growth and also just sort of a bigger debt load. But specific policy proposals, at least sort of on the, you know, more macro side, I think it's a little bit too soon to say on that.
2020 really is not that far away, scarily. I can't believe it.
And the debates are starting soon. I mean, I think that's why equity investors really need to pay attention, because they are going to get hit over the head with these issues starting in a few weeks.
With that said, though, Mike, I believe it is that time.
Yeah, it's my favorite time of the week. Our regular ritual, the craziest thing I ever saw in markets, parentheses this week. Sarah, I'm going to start with you. What do you got?
Okay. So we don't really usually venture into the commodities market this week, but I thought something pretty interesting did happen. So one of our reporters did point out that if you look at the ratio of soybean futures to corn, it is now lowest in 6 years. No, but there's a reason. There's a reason for it, because
that sounds more like a recipe problem.
Right. Well,
my salad.
There's going to be good news that will come out of it. But the idea is that when you plant in an acre, you get more corn, soybeans per acre. So the ratio has to be higher in order for farmers to say it's worth it to plant soybeans over corn. So because that has now dropped so low, the idea is we could get more corn this summer. Exciting.
Wonderful.
You're really enthused right now, Brian.
Yeah, well, I'm from the Midwest. I love my corn.
Lori, did they warn you about our gimmick here, the craziest thing we've ever seen in markets?
I am actually a listener of the podcast, I was very well prepared for this.
Fantastic. All right, what do you got?
Okay, so I've been debating between two, and I think the one I'll start with, I'll just keep it in the political realm given our conversation earlier, but what really jumped out at me, and I think this is one of those things I'll just sort of never forget, is watching Bob Mueller do his press conference at the Department of Justice, insisting that his report spoke for itself. And the reason I bring this up is it just, to me, epitomized how odd things have been as an equity strategist since 2016. I have talked about politics more than I was ever told that I should. It used to be that we were supposed to stay out of the political realm. It was too controversial. Right. We cannot get out of meetings this year without talking about politics. I purposefully try not to bring it up a lot of the time. But what I think was interesting to me is that it's something that's really not on investors' radars, yet it was right there front and center on the Bloomberg. And I do think it has implications. If you talk to most equity investors, they'll tell you, we don't think impeachment's going to happen. We're ignoring this. We did a survey back in September, and we asked people how markets would react if Trump got impeached but not convicted. And people were completely split. They had no idea how to trade it. We asked them, what would you buy and what would you sell? They had no idea what to buy or sell. So they're just totally ignoring it because they don't know what to do, and they don't think it's likely to happen. But I do think the fact that, you know, we saw Mueller insist that this report speaks for itself. Well, it seems like it doesn't.
Right.
This issue is not going away. And I do think we have to consider how that impacts the 2020 elections, where the vast majority of people I talk to think that Trump is going to win. I personally think it's going to be close. Yeah. And I think we're just setting up for another year where we're going to be paying attention to things like this. We are going to be spending much more time than historically we would on an election.
Right. And no one will trust any of the polls at all. It's got to be about a 30-point spread, I think, for people to trust the polls.
Absolutely.
I was writing a note at 11 o'clock on the last presidential election at night.
You had to redo it then in the middle of the night.
I had to redo it. I'm sure I'm going to be up all night when this one comes around as well.
All right, Brian Chapata, I have a strong faith in you as far as picking out crazy things in markets.
You know, I didn't plan this, but I am also going with the commodities space.
Eight years ago,
I started at Bloomberg as an agricultural commodities reporter. So going back to my roots, looking at coffee.
No pun intended.
Did you ever write about the corn to soybean ratio?
I wrote about corn and I wrote about soybeans. I did not write about the fabled ratio that Sarah brought up. No, but coffee futures earlier this month set the low, depending on which contract you look at, was either the lowest in 9 years or in 14 years. But someone did not tell that to Clatch Coffee Roasters in San Francisco because they were offering up cups of coffee for $75 each.
How?
$75.
It's insane. They just happened to buy this very select, very premium roast that only, you know, there were only, you know, a small batch, whereas throughout the rest of the world, there's just such an inundation of supply in coffee that these futures were taking a tumble. So, you know, in San Francisco, they are immune to the sort of cheapening of coffee.
I want to meet someone that bought a $75 cup. In fact, I might even buy that cup of coffee just to see if it's
just
worth
to say that you did.
It's the Oscars for coffee. They told the Sacramento Bee. So
this is pretty good. This is good competition for the craziest thing we've ever seen in markets this week. Sarah, I'll tell you mine. You set the precedent by going into the art market a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. which I think is a valid. It's a tradable asset
yes,
class.
Yes, absolutely.
It's quickly becoming my favorite market as far as crazy things go. And I'll tell you about the story the New York Times had this week. It's about this artist named Peter Max, who was very popular in the hippie era. And lately, in recent years, they've made a business out of auctioning off his artwork on cruise ships. There's galleries on cruise ships, and the idea is basically you're on a cruise, you're having a good time, you're maybe having a few cocktails, you maybe don't have the Wi-Fi to check on the prices of what this guy's art typically sells for. So next thing you know, you're off the cruise, and you're like, wait, I paid how much for what now?
So they jack up the prices on the cruise ship?
Well, yeah, apparently. That's what the allegation in the which makes a lot of sense. Lori, imagine if they only sold stocks on cruise ships. And they'd be like,
what a
Tesla,
world.
I would have the best job in the world.
I'll pay $1,000 a share. Now, if that's not crazy enough, it gets even crazier. Now, poor Peter Max is getting older. He's suffering from dementia. It's not clear that he can even paint anymore. Yet, they have this studio with quote-unquote assistant artists who basically are making paintings in the style of Peter Max. And then he comes in like every now and then and just signs his name to all of them. And then they send him off to the cruise ship where they're selling for tens of thousands
of dollars.
So
they're not even him.
So allegedly, at least not all of them are him. I mean, the implication of the story is that none of them are his, basically.
Nothing about that's good.
Nothing's good.
Really nothing's
Brian
good.
Brian says you lose.
But the art market's so crazy that I'm wondering if this will just drive prices up. They're like, oh, I got one of the fake Peter Maxes that the New York Times heard about. So
it is pretty crazy.
That's the craziest thing I've ever seen in markets. That's got to be all the art market talk we can do for this year.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if you can come up with something new. But with that said, Brian Chapata, Lori Calvasina, thank you so much for joining us today. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. Our guest, Lori Calvasina, is at Lori Calvasina. And Brian Chapata is at B Chapata. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.